Now, before I introduce Fiona Paisley to you, historian extraordinaire, I want you to have a listen to this. It's from an away programme, first broadcast in 2007. It'll give you an idea of the bloke we're going to talk about.
Picture London, in the grip of fog, and the well-fed, black-coated, bowler-hatted clerks and businessmen with their umbrellas and galoshes slopping along the Strand. Great Scott, what's this? Against the solid stone of Australia House stands a grotesque figure, a black man, hatless and with a grey beard, a mere handful of a man, with the fine bones of an Australian Aborigine. He is old and the cold is biting him. Like a figure of fun, he stands in a greatcoat which reaches from his ears to his ankles. And on the greatcoat, pinned from top to bottom, are scores of those little white penny skeletons that the street vendors sell to children. Good Lord, the man is a walking graveyard, yet his eyes are on fire. He points to the penny skeletons and shouts as people pass,
"This is all Australia has left of my people."
Then from the entrance of Australia House, showcase of a nation, which inside 130 years or so had all but wiped out a happy, handsome people, issues a neatly dressed official who runs down the pavement and calls a London bobby.
That is the most extraordinary scene, Fiona. What year are we talking about?
Well, we think sometime in late 1920s, probably around 1928, was indeed when that policeman came along and tried to stop Fernando's protests.
Very dramatic. Love the toy skeletons representing a dying race at the hands of British colonialism. And what a great setting he chose.
He did. He's a remarkable figure, and this is one of the creative protests that he staged during his four decades living in England and Europe. And in each case, he showed a similar creativity, a sense for the dramatic, and also the ability to take what was at hand and turn it into political weapons, if you like. Part of his way of surviving overseas was being a trader, and one of the things he traded on the street was toys. So there he is selling toys, but then turning them into symbols of his analysis of the frontier.
At the head of the program, I was talking about a career that covered quite a lot of professions. Here he is, the son of an Aboriginal woman and apparently an African-American convict in the First Fleet. And he works as, a welder, toy maker, jewellery maker, trader, servant. He was a very skilled survivor.
Yes, he was indeed a survivor, and I think he was an inveterate traveller as well, and he loved Europe and travelling around. So he survived. At that time, he was working as a very valued cook and manservant for a couple of lawyers just down the road from Australia House, actually off Fleet Street, probably the most stable part of his life. And so you can imagine him on his day off walking down to Australia House to stage his protest, and then indeed further on up to Hyde Park Corner, where he was a speaker there as well, and I'm sure a highly dramatic and thunderous haranguer of the English and international visitors.
Fiona, you write that despite the itinerancy of his life overseas, and we'll deal with that shortly, Fernando's Aboriginality remained his constant inspiration. Tell us about, first of all, I have to ask you, Fernando?
Isn't it fascinating? There are several layers to that name. For a while, it was thought that possibly he was related to many of the Fernandos in northern New South Wales who were descended from a Sri Lankan sailor who jumped ship but in the 1880s, so 20 years after Fernando was born. But very late in my research, I found a document where he actually gives a completely different name for his parents. He names them as Mariano and Sarah Silva. And this fits with a story he did tell supporters and Anglo-Australian humanitarians in London, that he adopted the name Fernando in honour of the Italian people. He loved Italy. He was a Roman Catholic. It was, of course, the home of his religion, Rome. And so it could very well be that he chose the name Fernando in their honour. And certainly he travelled under the name of Anthony Martin Fernando. So there's many layers to that fascinating story.
At the heart of the story of Fernando's childhood is a painful separation. Tell us about that.
Yes, he spoke about his mother as the guiding star of his life. But very sadly, he was separated from her as a child. We have to be careful here, I guess, reading back. And it's possible he was taken in the sense that we understand from the stolen generations. But also, she may have realised she had a very intelligent son and the opportunity of him being educated, say, by a missionary family and being taken in by them may have been a great opportunity.
And, of course, record-keeping in the mid-19th century in New South Wales rarely included Aboriginal birth. So the story of these early years emerges from a patchwork of sources.
It does. It's been a real detective story that's ranged not only in Australia but into England and various archives in Europe, including in Italy, Swiss archives and so on. And there's very little in Australia that tells us about the first, more or less, 40 years of his life. So we rely on the narratives that he conveyed to our supporters, who then often wrote letters to each other about this extraordinary man they'd met. And one of his main stories, formative stories, is the separation from his mother, not just being away from her and returning, and sadly to find that she'd passed away by the time he came back, but also that his experience of being educated by a white family taught him the very limits of settler colonialism. He was really, he felt, treated, he said, like a dog, rather like a pet. An experiment, and he resented that all his life, because his argument was that education, knowledge about the world, provided the weapons and the tools in which to negotiate with European culture.
The man was eloquent. He could use words very skillfully, and this itself would have puzzled and to some extent confronted white people.
Words were his greatest weapon. Also, after he left Australia, his own presence, literally his presence on the street. And in his protests, of course, that was his way of identifying himself as an Aboriginal Australian. He was most often misinterpreted as an Indian or an Arab, occasionally as an African. So words and language, he does seem to have loved words. He was a great reader of the Bible. He loved the Old Testament, so he had a very Old Testament turn of phrase, very dramatic words like, he called missions the murder houses of Australia. He called the Australian Aboriginal people the lords and ladies of Australasia. He was certainly a very dramatic speaker, I'm sure.
Where was he educated?
Well, aside from this early experience with a missionary family, possibly being placed in a mission. It is possible over in Western Australia in New Norcia, because in 1903 he was in Western Australia. It's the first time his own words appear in the archives, and he was very critical at that time of New Norcia itself, but missions in general, in the way that someone who had experienced them firsthand and had become very disillusioned might be. But I think he was a lifelong learner, and this is something that he read a great deal, he read the newspapers, and not only was he commenting on Aboriginal Australia, but he also wrote about contemporary events that he read about. And he really linked up settler colonial Australia with his larger criticism of Britain and its behaviour in the world.
Fiona, let's backtrack a little on the story, because we haven't dealt with his father. There's two different narratives.
It's the best we can do with the current information we have is assume that his father was part of the South Asian diaspora, people from Sri Lanka and India, in that Indian Oceanic world, you know, that is on the Western Australian coast, but also people we're familiar with, like, Afghan Kamilias and from northern India. So there was a very significant presence of Indians and South Asians in Australia. So if we go from the surname Silva, it would seem that would be most likely.
Okay. Now, right from right from day one, effectively. He's pretty bolshy. The first words that appear in the archives, he writes to the Chief Protector of Aborigines in Perth to challenge the approach to Aboriginal affairs. I mean, he's off and running.
He certainly is. I think it is a real pivotal moment in his life, because after this he leaves for good. He doesn't come back, and he has a sense he can never come back. And he writes from a small gold mining town in Western Australia where he has...
This is Peak Hill?
It's Peak Hill.
Yeah.
He's apparently witnessed police brutality towards local Aboriginal people. And he writes a number of letters, only one of which actually makes it into the archive and got as far as the Aborigines Protection Board, which does lead me to conclude that possibly the first two were intercepted and perhaps by the policeman himself. Certainly the story gets out, and Fernando is known now for sending these accusations off to the Chief Protector. And as he writes in the third letter, his own life is now in danger.
Okay, education, general education is one thing. Political education is another. How does he become radicalised? Do we know of his political inspirations?
I think we can only deduce them from some of his writings, and this is the other side of the detective work. There are so many gaps in the story, and in order to provide a kind of context for the moments where he does appear in the archive, where he's so clever and determined that he does appear in the archive, we really have to read outwards from his writing. So, for example, in 1903, he refers to himself as a hard-working black man, capital B. But he's also later in life very anti the Bolshevik Revolution. So I think we can find his politics actually much closer to his religious views than we might assume.
Right.
You know, that the church and Roman Catholicism provides him with a way to understand himself as
and
he
saw,
in front
he saw
of God.
No contradiction in terms between his celebration of Aboriginality and the mission culture and the religious dominance of Aboriginal people by European religion.
Yeah, he's an interesting combination. He makes us have to reassess, I guess, a lot of assumptions, and one of those would be the value of the political value of religious discourse. So the idea of being equal in front of God. He was very hostile towards missions and the mission system, but he saw a true religiosity and a true faith in God as aligned to the ideas of civilization and human decency and the rule of law. So it was, he felt it was this kind of Old Testament God, you know, kind of God's wrath in the world. And he looked around him and he saw the British culture and civilization. He felt terribly impacted by the cruelties of colonialism. And so that Britain really wasn't being smiled on by God anymore. And you could see that in the Depression streets of London, for example, as a kind of literal materialisation of that.
So in a way, when he leaves, he's leaving behind terrible experiences, terrible observations of police brutality, you know, shocking injustice. But he doesn't initially head for England, does he? It's Europe.
It's Europe. And there is a possibility that he had already been across to Europe and back. It's impossible to verify that. But there is a story that he had actually already travelled overseas as a young man. He's already calling himself Fernando by 1903, for example, and if that's in the name of the Italian people, perhaps he'd been to Italy before. But, yes, certainly he heads over to Europe. He goes and works in Vienna, and then he's in Trieste when World War I breaks out, and he's confined there and then interned during the war. And it's really after the war, during repatriation, as he comes back to Britain, that he's likely to have been issued with a British passport. And he also meets one of his future employers, a lawyer named Douglas Jones. And it's actually he's living in the Inner Temple just off Fleet Street in the 1920s, working for Jones and another lawyer.
And I understand that Jones encouraged him to start telling his story.
Well, Jones had a great idea that Fernando should, in fact, write down his story. Unfortunately, it never happened. But Fernando did post him three little notebooks, probably three out of many that he kept during his life, no doubt, as you would, as he was, apart from that short period of time when he was a manservant, most of the time he was a trader, travelling in Europe by train as far as Constantinople, for example. And so he would keep notebooks about his reception at markets, and he sent these three to Douglas Jones, I think it's his interpretation of sending him a kind of snapshot of his life. So he wanted Jones to know how difficult life was for him on the streets of London.
Just to give the listener a feeling of his energies, he spends the war years in internment camps, and on repatriation he receives the British passport you mentioned. One of his first big protests was to walk into the headquarters of the Swiss newspaper, Der Bund, in June 21, and he instantly gets the editors very interested and excited in his ideas about Aboriginal conditions. What did his open letter to the Swiss readership say?
It was a call to the Swiss people, and he was really interpreting a contemporary interest in internationalism, the great hope that the League of Nations and the new international world order would see a change in empire and colonialism and race relations and so on. So it was part of a world movement, many ex-colonials, but also, as it turns out, the editors of this progressive newspaper. And what Fernando did was he took contemporary ideas and he radicalised them and, if you like, indigenised them. And in this case, he agrees with them that a really proper reserve system for Aboriginal people for land in Australia would be important. But he takes it a step further. Rather than most of the other progressives of his day who thought that system could be set up under British Australian control, his argument was that only with the League of Nations committee, with, say, European powers, and he named the Netherlands and Switzerland as two possible powers, only with oversight of European nations directly with authority over Aboriginal land could you be ensured that that land would be inviolable.
Fiona, the protest that you regard as his most striking and significant takes place in Rome in 1925. Tell us about that.
Well, I'll set the scene. It's 1925, the Jubilee, one of the periodic celebrations of Roman Catholicism, where pilgrims would come from around the world. And that year, the largest Australian contingent arrived, led by Archbishop Mannix, with Irish Catholics. It was a triumphal arrival in the city. Apparently, newspaper reports record that received with Viva Australia, and he had an audience with the Pope. So you can imagine it was an exciting moment, and they're getting to St. Peter's, the cathedral, and what should they find in the entrance but an Aboriginal man handing out flyers condemning British policy in Australia. And indeed, Fernando had thousands of flyers, 1,000 on his person, apparently, another 9,000 back at his lodgings. And so fascist police were tipped off that there was because the British were allies of Italy, so it was seen as an anti-British demonstration. And there was an undercover operation, and indeed the flyer that Fernando handed over to an undercover policeman is still on his file in Italian archives to this day.
This is Alan Dell on RN, and I'm talking to cultural historian Fiona Paisley. And this is one of the most extraordinary sagas I've ever heard on the program, the story of Fernando. So Mussolini's fascist state doesn't like people who harbour anti-state resistance, so he's thrown in the slammer. How did he get out?
Well, he was in there for a couple of months and wasn't able to write any letters. And as soon as he got pen and paper, he wrote to his former employer in London, Douglas Jones, who was able to pull some strings and so got his, well, extradition. It wasn't release, but finally got something to happen. And so he was taken by train in the middle of the night, he said, and forced to walk over the Alps into France.
We're running out of time and we haven't there's so much to tell. Yeah. But I love the story about he gets back to London, apart from protesting outside Australia House, a regular at Hyde Park Corner. He gets arrested and tried in London for assault and held on remand in Brixton. Apparently pulled out a gun on a neighbouring stallholder. What was going on there?
Well, I interpret it as a political act. He recorded many worse examples of racial taunting. This stallholder told him to go home and wash his face. I mean, just routine racism.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he lunged. His big complaint, Fernando's complaint, was that police never intervened on his behalf. And so he pulled out a pistol. It couldn't be fired, as it turned out. It was really a prop. And he waves it around in front of all these witnesses. And he gets his day in court. And so there he is by this time in his, you know, 60s, stands up. And I've been to the Central Criminal Court and imagine him standing in the dock speaking to the judge, one of the foremost judges in the land, who actually accepts his argument that he committed the crime because he had so lost faith in justice in Australia.
What a bloke this fellow is, isn't he? The story of an Aboriginal man speaking against Australia from a London court.
Yes.
And he gets a sympathetic response, a much more sympathetic response there than he got here.
Absolutely. And we think about court cases in Australia, the notorious, for example, the notorious Judge Wells in the Northern Territory a few years later, who openly dismissed any Aboriginal testimony in court, especially, of course, against white men or policemen, as inherently untrustworthy. So not only is Fernando being heard, but his case against Australia is being accepted as a defence in order to make sure that he didn't go to prison. And in fact, he was released.
How and where and when did Anthony Martin Fernando die?
Well, there are many mysteries about this man's life, and this is one of them, perhaps the most poignant. He, in old age, by World War II, he had been committed to a large mental hospital. It's worse than it sounds in that it was a very modern hospital and it was really an old age facility. So he spent the war there and passed away in 1949. We have a death certificate. We know that he was suffering from senility and various illnesses of old age. He had been, his body and his mind had been under a lot of stress and strain, of course, periods of incarceration, but also he was on the road so much. And I think each of his protests caused him not only a sense of satisfaction and a capacity to tell his story, but also, of course, a mental burden as well. And so with the death certificate, he was a pauper, it would have been a pauper burial, an unmarked grave, but yet it's been impossible to find any record of which cemetery he was buried in.
Fiona, why the hell, that we all know the story, well, we know now thanks to you, but this is one of the most remarkable people in Australian history.
Yes, it's a very interesting question, and it's one that has puzzled me. I think possibly that we've been focused on a kind of national history and we've found transnational history or the idea of Aboriginal people actually moving outwards from Australia, quite difficult to fathom. And most of us have really gone through, the 1990s and 2000s, and we've learned a lot about protective policies, so-called protection, which appeared to limit Aboriginal people's capacity to move around. So he seems to contradict our assumptions.
Fiona, you've done him proud. Fiona Paisley, Associate Professor in the School of Humanities at Griffith, her book, The Lone Protester, A.M. Fernando, in Australia and Europe, published by Aboriginal Studies Press. You can hear Fernando's story on Away here on RN on Saturday night at 6 p.m. And Fernando's ghost follows the man as he travels across Europe, gets locked up. Well, we've given you a hint of the saga. Saturday night at 6 p.m, again on Tuesday night at 9 here on RN. We'll put links on our website for more information about the program and indeed more information about Fiona's book. On our next, The King is Dead, Long Live the Queen. Well, he's not dead. King Bob of Tasmania has abdicated and there's a new leader of the Australian Greens, Senator Christine Milne, and I'd like you to get to know her. So tomorrow, an hour with Christine Milne. That's your lot from LN on RN, and we will see you later.